You have reached the telephone mailbox of Waldo Bastian. Please get ready to record a message. Please hang up when finished.
Okay! Season 4!
Episode 3.
Yes.
Yep,
here
absolutely.
We are again.
Stole your thunder,
this is Lug Radio. I'm Abe Bradshaw.
Matthew Revelle here.
I'm John O'Bacon.
And I'm Stuart Langridge.
So what we're going to talk about on this show of shows...
Hamilton Academicals.
How is it a show of shows?
It's,
just,
show.
It's just a show.
Yeah.
Of,
there's many other shows.
It's a show of
It's a show of segments.
It's a show of segments, yes.
Yeah,
on the like show of segments,
segments,
we will be talking about...
John Academy.
Cherry. Academy. Yes.
Oh, yeah, we've talked. We've been to Guardex, so
yes.
Might as well get Academy.
Sadly, we couldn't make it to Academy, which is the KD equivalent of Guardex.
You can next year.
The KD
not Dublin anyway.
Yeah.
You can go to Academy.
Well, I can't. But yeah, it's in Dublin at Trinity College, or it has been, because we're actually recording this after the Academy event.
Yes.
We should explain.
No, we're recording it before the Academy event.
Yeah.
By the time you listen to it, it'll be after the Academy
event.
Because,
right.
Jono?
That time and things. Tricky, isn't it?
Ooh.
We recorded the last show last night, and we recorded tonight's show tonight, obviously.
Oh, now it makes so much more sense.
On the 20th of September.
Because I'm going on holiday, so you can we can deliver your injection of Lug Radio goodness.
Your bi-weekly Lug Radio goodness, despite the fact that Jono's not here.
Yes, yeah, so we've doing two episodes in the same week, so but we really wanted to do something about Academy, so we've...
So if anything massively important has happened in Linux in the last 3 weeks and you're wondering why we haven't mentioned it, because it hasn't happened yet.
What else are we talking about?
And there's no emails, so because we shut our email load last night.
We did indeed, yes.
Yep. Okay, so
and a mighty load it was.
As part of our celebrations of Academy, which, by the way, as we haven't really explained, is a KDE conference.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like KDE's Guardec, or Guardec is
and Guardec
Gnome's
is like,
Academy. I'm not sure which came first, to be honest with you.
That'll help.
Divna.
Tell you what, Google it.
Yeah. So what's on the show?
Right, we've got John Cherry from the Open Source Development Labs, who was speaking, or is going to be speaking, at Academy.
He's keynoting, isn't he?
Yeah, he's keynoting about the future of the Linux desktop and corporation on it and all that sort of
and
thing.
And the old Portland thing.
Yep. We're also talking to...
Waldo Bastian
about the Portland project.
Yeah,
he's a bit of a KDE legend and now working for Intel, so...
yeah,
he is.
And the Portland thing seems interesting. A lot of people sort of keep saying, oh, it's quite interesting, but not a lot of people know much about it, so Mr. Bastian on the show.
Hopefully
also,
we can
also each
you.
One of us is going to choose one piece of closed source software that we would really like to see open source.
Yes.
Yep, and we're going to talk about, leading on from talking about Academy specifically, talk about conferences generally. Conferences, corporate awards, things like that, whether you think they're
love
useful, whether you don't
them.
Think they're useful. Be interested in your thoughts on that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
So that's about it, really.
Let's crack on. Now, we're an open source podcast.
Indeed,
we talk about open source software.
I'm sure it says that on the website somewhere.
It certainly does. Aid had a brilliant idea about doing a segment about which closed source applications we'd like to see open source.
It
sounds like a simple concept, but
it does. But
I don't
it's
know if
not quite as easy as it sounds.
So
come on, let's do it.
Let's
okay.
go for it.
Who's going to go first?
I suppose the obvious one that you would think, definitely it'd be Office. But I thought about this and I thought, well, no, I probably wouldn't. Because the whole thing about Office is it's the formats that really are the problem.
Right.
And the next version of Office, they'll probably just subtly change the format again, and then you'll be fucked again.
So you won't be fucked again because it'll be open source.
Yes, but listen, I've been thinking about this recently.
I mean, yeah, it's difficult because... sorry, interrupting slightly, but...
Amazing.
But the Abbey Word people, quite a few of them say, why doesn't Abbey Word read Word documents right? And they go, because it's really hard. And everyone says, so why don't you just use the thing from OpenOffice? And they say, because it's really complicated and integrated. So I think Microsoft Office would be exactly the same. But you would at least be able to look through it and hopefully understand the formats a bit more.
Yeah.
It would help the OpenOffice people sharpen up their Word importer. Well, no, I can't really think of anything, but carry on.
Right,
sorry,
okay.
Matt was going to make a point.
I was going to say that I reckon if Microsoft did OpenOffice, did unencumber Office, to use the old Storm and Magic, then you would have a situation where they would probably do it in such a way that it was open enough for governments and everyone like that to be happy with it.
But
it would fuck everyone else over.
Yeah, yeah.
But nobody would really realise.
It wouldn't be actually free. And
but if we were talking about GPL in a bit of software or something,
you'd almost think that would be like them saying, yeah, it's GPL, but we hold patents on all the stuff.
Yeah.
Which is exactly why software patents are a problem.
Yeah. So,
would you do Exchange? Would you open source Exchange?
No, because that's... See, the thing is,
What, see, the reason I wouldn't is because we're almost there now with Zimbra and things like that.
Yeah.
And
there's less of a need for it.
Yeah.
The reason I wouldn't is that if you suddenly just open source all this closed source software, then you
it's
don't...
It's a level playing field.
No, no, you don't. Oh, right. You don't necessarily have a better situation for the open source world, because what you do is you kill innovation straight away. See, whereas we can build better solutions like Firefox...
Why would open source net kill innovation?
Surely it would encourage it.
Because you've got the most used software in the world, just about, which is suddenly free, which would make a lot of people who are scratching the itch of wanting more free software...
Oh, no, that's the whole... that's the whole we can only do stuff if we're chasing other people's tail lights argument.
No, it's not. I reckon it would put a lot of people off bothering to develop.
I don't think so.
Why? Don't know, what would you open source?
Well, I was thinking about this, right?
Cubase.
The obvious choice for me would probably be something like Cubase, but no, I'm choosing something a little bit different, because I wouldn't use Cubase. I'd use Jocosha, and so Cubase wouldn't really be interesting.
Bid, go on, then use Jocosha. You'd use Jocosha 6 months.
Oh no,
now.
No, I'll be when it's developed. But I'm not interested in Cubase on Linux. But what I am interested in is that amp behind you, Matthew P. Ravel.
Yeah.
That's a digital modelling amp, and what it does, you plug
is
your guitar
that also
in.
Also known as a DMA.
Eh? No. Yeah. And you know, you plug your guitar in, when you play something, it basically models the different amps in software, and it's quite cool. And their software is completely proprietary. Mm. I'd like to see that open sourced, because then that'll mean that people can make their own amp sort of noises and sounds for the Line 6 gear, but also, you know, for computers as well.
How would you persuade Line 6 to do that? What argument would you use? Because that would then turn their hardware, their software into a commodity, which is probably the only differentiator between their hardware and anybody else's.
I think it's even harder to do it for someone like Line 6, because their value in it is entirely in the software. Because it's basically just a computer with a speaker on the edge.
So,
you know, it's not like if you get a Mesa Boogie amp, then you're getting, it's all valve driven and stuff like that, so it's all...
Yeah, yeah.
It's all kind of custom
hardware. So the quality's in the equipment
and then they've got
a bog standard piece of equipment that's driven cleverly by the software.
Yeah.
So you can't think of anything.
Hang on a sec. Can we just? I'm quite interested in this because I see the value in opening a lot of things, but as a company, I think they would say that basically they wouldn't have any reason then to innovate or develop.
There's absolutely no reason why they would.
Really, I mean, this comes down to an argument of whether everything should be open, because in some ways, if that doesn't remain like a black box, I mean, it is a black box physically, but if it doesn't remain a closed system, then there's no reason for Line 6 to continue.
Yeah, I mean,
all they end up is churning out commodity hardware.
I mean, this is obviously about stuff we'd like to open source. And
sure, yeah, I'm just interested.
I mean, I'd say it's harder for someone like Line 6 to open source their software because it's so, in many ways, they're more dependent on their software than someone like Microsoft are. Because... Mm. That is completely useless without the software.
Yeah.
And Microsoft do other stuff. They could open source, Office and still sell Windows. Yeah, it would dramatically affect their business model. But if you did that to Line 6, it would basically completely kill them. So, but what would be cool is I'd love to see people writing their own.
What about
their own
API
virtual apps
then?
Exactly. API? Like an open API. I mean, that'd be great.
Open standards rather than open source.
But what I'd like to see happen is I'd like to see the software that's running on that amp running on my computer. So
you can pirate it.
Basically, yeah. I want amp wares. so you know, I can, you know, one of the instruments in Jocosha would be, you know, a 1960s Marshall amp.
Yeah.
Or a Mesa Boogie Traxxas or something, you know.
Can't you just go to ampelavista.box.sk and download?
But yeah, so that would be cool. And it would give a boost to the lads' bit effort as well. And, you know, the whole, because there's not enough kind of people working on effects and shit because it's just so damn hard. So so I'm plumping for that.
What about proprietary 3D graphics drivers?
That's an interesting one.
Now you see that's the thing.
Right.
I said earlier when we were talking about this segment, I said that I have to use proprietary software at work, but there's nothing that I use there that is significantly better than anything I use with free software at home.
Uh-huh.
There's nothing in particular where I go, that's so much better. I actually want to use that because it's a much better thing.
Right.
But while John was talking about that, it occurred to me that I hadn't really thought about drivers and things like that. So if I had to pick something, it would be the ATI and NVIDIA drivers.
If you're measuring it like that.
Or possibly the Broadcom drivers. Right. But it would be device drivers generally. But I can't think of application software that I personally think would be good or that I think would be generally good for the community. Jono mentioned games.
Yep.
But I'm not necessarily sure that would really buy you anything. Because just having one game open source doesn't help much.
Well, it doesn't have to help, though.
What about a game engine, though?
There already are game engines.
Yeah, but why does it have to help? Why should choosing something to be open source necessarily have to help open source? It's just that you want that application and the source code available so people can modify that specific
right,
game.
Right, so we're talking about for selfish
but it could
reasons.
Be for selfish. I mean, my example is a very selfish kind of reason, yeah. but... It could potentially spur things on. Let's say Max Payne. You've played Max Payne before on your completely free software operating system that you'd never run any proprietary software on, and you play Max Payne, right?
Yeah.
Right? So if they open source that...
With wine, I think.
It's still proprietary software.
The game is, yeah, absolutely.
So if they open source Max Payne, wouldn't it be cool that people could make... spin-offs of Max Payne.
No, to be honest with you, I would think that would be a great idea in theory, if it wasn't for the fact that ID did open source Quake and Quake 2 and Quake 3, and there's not that much in the way of brilliant open source innovations built on top of the code
that
base.
I mean,
there are a few sort of game-ish bits out there, but the difficult thing about writing games is not the engine.
Yeah, well,
it's all the artwork and
the
setup. We've talked about this a lot. So having that particular game open source wouldn't buy you that much, because you can't... You couldn't take the Max Payne stuff and innovate it into a different game.
But I suspect...
Because then you'd need to do all new artwork, but which I suspect is just that, as fucking hard.
That would be the case, I suspect, with if Microsoft Office was opened. It's such a massive wad of code that I think you get very, very few people doing kind of relatively innovative stuff with that chunk of code. I mean, look at OpenOffice.
Oh, yeah, but there aren't that many people doing it with OpenOffice.
Exactly.
There aren't many people doing it with Mozilla, because it's such a hard code base.
Because it's so hard to do stuff for. So, in many ways, it makes more sense for open source, I hate to use the word vertical markets.
Yes.
Right, but that's, like, for example, the Line 6 thing, or for small applications where it's more likely people are going to get involved and do something with it.
Yeah, I mean, the ATI drivers are, to some extent, a vertical market in that sense. I mean, that's a lot... Your Line 6 AMP thing's a lot more vertical, if that's the right way of describing it.
So is there anything else that we think that... I mean,
I wouldn't mind the turn, motherfuckers.
You what?
Neither would I actually.
Oh, I thought you'd...
you forget about us too sometimes, don't you?
you fucking liar! Carry on.
Much like Ack, I don't use any proprietary software at home that I know of anyway. I might have accidentally installed something, but I don't think so, on any of my PCs.
How was you using Max Payne, not using proprietary software?
When did I say that?
This is Max
Payne.
I mean, the things that are semi-proprietary that I did use, and Jono had a go at me, so I uninstalled them, are things like M-Player. And they are open source.
We've discussed this.
The problem is the codec stuff.
Okay.
So, yeah, I use codecs, I think, like MP3 I'm happy to use. But anyway... I would open source basically the whole NHS system that they're putting into place at the moment, and basically anything to do with government, because it really fucks me off when my tax money is spent to prop up proprietary systems and our data is basically locked away. I went into this a little bit a couple of weeks ago when we were talking to Peer War. And we're talking about kind of Diebold and stuff like that.
God, is it that long ago?
Amazing. I find it difficult to think back that far.
Seems like only yesterday.
It does seem like only yesterday. Yes. So
But basically anything where public money is spent and public information is involved.
Can I ask you a question?
It's already
that?
Starting to happen, isn't it?
In terms of that, I think that's a good, really good point. Do you believe that is your reason for it being open source just because private information is held behind proprietary software and the kind of the obfuscation of that kind of thing? Or is it because you believe that if it was open source, it would stop the amount of waste going on in terms of people fucking up contracts and stuff?
I've got two reasons. One is just a pure matter of principle that
tax money
should not be spent to develop closed box systems.
Exactly.
That we should have access to every part of it. You know, if you go and if the local council builds a school, the builder doesn't say to them, "Oh no, you can't put a new tap on the toilet in 15 years' time. We've got to come back and do it. And you'll never see the insides of the system because it's special and it's secret to us." You know, a bog's a bog, right? So when you create an NHS system, it should be similar, right? So just out of pure principle. Secondly, it's to do with data. The fact that all this data can be tied up and held to ransom by a small group of developers and you know, the companies behind it.
Which was the Peruvian argument.
Yes,
and the Brazilian argument.
Absolutely,
as well.
Brazilian argument.
And taking your point, I hadn't really thought about that in this segment. But yes, definitely. What was it again?
About whether there'd be as much waste.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Because yeah.
I suspect if it was open source, it would be the same level of waste.
There'd be exactly the same amount of waste. Because the government would still pay EDS or CSC.
Or some other company.
That's all the contracts there are. Capgemini.
Yeah.
They'd still pay them 300 million quid to develop the system. The fact that all the code ends up on SourceForge at the end of the day is not the point. They'd still be sending all that tax money to there. Would it be a massive contribution? It's only a massive contribution if you're also running a health service, which means the Swedish could use it and no other fucker could.
Well, maybe
no other country in the world runs a health service.
Not like ours.
Oh, okay.
No, they don't. I'm not taking the piss here. The NHS is great for a reason.
But it's still a massive contribution.
Though. It's a massive contribution of code. I mean, your line six thing.
Selfish little git.
It's open, but and it would be a contribution. But again, it's very, very narrowly tailored.
Yes.
The people making amplifiers just like theirs. Which is why I can absolutely see the Line 6 people saying we're not going to do that, because the only thing that can happen there is that other people could steal some of our market.
Yeah.
And that would, be pointless. Eight?
Well, you kind of blow mine away, really, because that's a much better idea. I was just going to... I mean, like Access, I mean, there's nothing that I use every day in work, apart from maybe one thing. There's nothing that I use that there isn't an equivalent in open source now that's just as good. The only one thing that there isn't, and again, I'm coming back to Visio, but yeah, I mean, hardly compares, really, does it?
This
at
length, yeah. And I was quite surprised. I didn't really realise, I suppose, how powerful Visio is. Because to me, when I use it at work, it's either for project planning or flowcharts.
It's not just flowcharts.
Look, I can do a flowchart. Brilliant. End of Visio use. And then you find that every network engineer in the world uses it every day to build network diagrams.
I'm surprised that you didn't suggest the bits in Active Directory that we can't do on Linux, like all the deployment kind of...
The group policy stuff. Directory server stuff is already done, and the group policy stuff,
Because I'd have thought that would have been a really valuable contribution in terms of something being open source, because then people could build it in to work with other open sources.
Linux desktops are managed differently, though, aren't they? I mean, Red Hat have got systems to do that, and Novell have got systems to do that.
That was going to be exactly my point when you talked about Exchange earlier. Yeah. Open source Exchange would mean we could all use it, but it's still Exchange.
Yeah.
I don't actually like the way Exchange works. It's not just that it's proprietary. I don't like the way Outlook and Exchange talk and the way they do it and what they do. So you'd still be using Exchange. It would help make Evolution talk to Exchange, for example.
Mm. Yeah.
But quite possibly the best solution is not to use Exchange. It's to use Xim for mail and some other calendaring thing for calendaring and use lots of little applications on the server rather than one great big monolithic Exchange.
Can I go back very quickly to what I was saying before? When I said that I think that if you opened up a load of Microsoft software, it would harm open source. I do genuinely believe that, because I think all you'd be doing is cementing the monopoly a little bit more of Microsoft, because then they'd be able to go, we're good guys now.
You see, I don't care if Microsoft have a monopoly if all the software is open.
Yeah, but it would have... to me, I don't care if they've got a monopoly. I would still care, but I would care less if it was free.
So do you believe that if they open the software
and it was
properly free... Do you believe that people would just continue to use that software?
I think a lot of people would, yeah.
I mean, very quick question.
Because they do now when it's not free.
If Microsoft opened up Office, right, do you think other people would rebadge that software as their own Office, or do they just plunder the bits they want and make the existing open source offices better?
No idea, mate.
We should keep that for another segment.
Yeah. Okay.
That really deserves a full segment, because that would be quite interesting.
Thanks, mate.
I mean, just to reiterate the point there, if all Microsoft software was open and everything, and everyone still used Microsoft software, I don't mind at that point, because at that point it's open source. A lot of my argument with Microsoft goes away at that point. I don't hate Microsoft just because they begin with the letter M. I hate them because they release proprietary software. If you've got monopoly and using open source software, I don't care as much.
Yeah, still wouldn't use it because the software's not as good.
I don't happen to like their software, but fine.
Well, some of it is better, though.
Yeah, but some of it is better.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah.
Hi, Waldo Bastian, it's Lug Radio here.
Hello.
Hi, Lug Radio.
Hello.
Hello.
Bit of a transatlantic delay there. Okay, so you're speaking at Academy about Portland. Could you tell us what the whole Portland project's about?
Yes, I can. We've been with OSDL, Open Source Development Lab, and DDL, the Desktop Linux Workgroup of OSDL, We've been engaging with application developers that may in the future perhaps develop applications for Linux on the desktop. And one of the feedback that we get from them is that it's very hard to target Linux because there are many differences between all the different versions of Linux. So you have your different distributions, you have your different desktop environments. And it's quite a challenge for them to get a hold of that and to make applications that work everywhere.
Excellent.
So we talk with them and we try to understand what is going on there. And we came to the conclusion that we must help them to make it easier for them to make their applications and have those applications work everywhere, whether the user is using GNOME, whether the user is KDE, whether a user is using SUSE or Red Hat or Debian. That shouldn't matter. They should be able to have one set of tools that they can use to make an application and make that application work well with Linux, and then it should work in all those different environments, all those different desktops.
So can you give us... Sorry.
Yeah.
No, I was going to say, could you give us some practical examples of things that the Portland Project has produced to reach those goals, or is it at the moment very much in the planning stage?
No, we are almost done, I would say.
Wow.
We will be having the 1.0 release after Academy.
Ah, cool. Fantastic.
You just interrupted with me packaging up the first release candidate.
Wow.
All right, excellent.
Oh, sorry.
Get back to it.
So at the moment, Portland consists of two sets of tools. One set of tools is a set of installation tools. They are basically just shell scripts, nothing too fancy. But those shell scripts will allow an application to install itself in the menus. And that sounds quite simple.
Yeah.
But if you have an application and you want to have that application work on a wide variety of distributions, you will notice that every distribution has this small little crear that you need to work around with.
Yeah.
And so if you just make an application and expect it to work, that's very hard to work around all those issues and to make it work everywhere.
Right. Yeah.
So that's where we want to help out with by providing a set of tools that does that for you, by testing them on a large number of distributions.
Fantastic.
And then hoping that the distributions themselves will pick up these tools. We are working with LSB, and we hope that they will include these tools as well in the LSB specification, so that in the future application developers can rely on the distributions actually having these tools already installed.
It sounds really interesting. I mean, unfortunately, we've got to ask the question. There's been a lot of efforts in the past to standardize in different parts of the Linux desktop, and some of them have gone somewhere and some of them haven't gone somewhere. What would you say to the critics who are saying, this Portland project, it's not going to change the situation, it's still going to be as fragmented as ever?
Well, it's not going to change everything overnight, but it's a start. I think it's a valuable start. The feedback that we get from application developers is very positive. I had one person coming up to me at the Desktop Developers Conference in Ottawa this year saying, my God, how could I have missed this? This is so... We love this. This is really what we need. And it's not going to change everything. There will be a lot of areas that will be different between desktops and that will continue to cause problems. But I think this will be a big step forward and make a lot of relative easy tasks a lot easier, because at the moment they are just too hard to do. And they are really not that it's not rocket science putting an icon up in a menu. So it should be just easy, and at the moment it isn't. So with Portland, we try to change that.
Cool. One of the reasons that I hear a lot of people talk about Portland is that it makes it easier for ISVs to deliver applications across Linux distributions. And people seem to talk about this as though there's this huge, massive collection of ISVs who are dying out to deliver Linux applications, but can't manage it just because they can't be bothered to write something that puts an icon on the menu in two different distributions. But I don't know about any of these ISVs or any of the applications they're delivering. Is there this big library of applications out there where Portland's the only thing standing in between them and getting on with it? Or are you building the platform in the hope that people will then start to use it?
It's a bit of both. There are definitely companies out there that are looking at Linux and that want to move in when they think the time is right. Is putting an icon in the desktop stopping them? No, but it's one of the factors that makes it more difficult for them than it should be. So it's delaying their decision a little bit. I think the most important factor that drives them is their business concerns. Is there a market for Linux applications? And again, if it is easy to reach all the Linux distributions, because you mentioned two distributions, but if I count on DistroWatch, I count like 200.
If I look at the ones, enough.
Yeah, and if I look at the ones, so I work for Intel. If we look within Intel at the ones that we find relevant for a certain market, and if you look across different markets, it's not a stretch to come up with 20 different distributions. And so those are distributions that are relevant from a business point of view if you want to have a global market presence.
Cool.
Testing on 20 distributions is a lot of work. And if you can bring down that testing work, your equation of when it starts to make sense to enter the Linux the Linux desktop market with your products, it changes favorably.
Cool. Yeah,
so it's not a black and white thing, but it's one of the factors that contributes to people sitting on the fence and staying on the fence.
Hmm.
But
excellent.
I think this year we have seen quite some interesting movements there. We've seen a number of applications making the decision to enter the Linux market. We have seen the Google applications becoming available on Linux. We have the very interesting graphics application, Xara Extreme, that's being ported to Linux. So I think we see interesting movement there, and I think it will continue in 2007.
Excellent. A slightly different question then. You're speaking at Academy. Why do you think it's important to go to conferences like Academy? What's Academy going to do for you to help you push the Portland project?
I think it's important that the people involved in the KDE project, that they understand what third-party application developers need and expect from a platform like KDE, and to make sure that the KDE platform provides the tools and the things such developers need in order to successfully deliver their applications on the Linux platform.
For sure, yeah.
You mentioned that you work for Intel. Why is Intel interested in how well KDE and GNOME work together, or how well third-party software vendors can work with them?
Intel sells chips, and so in order to sell a chip, you need to have a use for those chips. Well, that use is sort of obvious. That's in computers.
Mm-hmm.
And people only want to use computers if those computers help them solve their problems, and if they have software to go with it, and that software must work well and must help them do their business.
So
if we have customers, maybe not our direct customers, but the customers from our customers, if they want to use Linux on Intel hardware, we want to make sure that they get the best experience possible. So we are interested to make sure that people that are running Intel hardware get the best experience possible.
That's interesting then. I mean, what's Intel doing more widely then within the Linux world? Because it sounds like there's a strategy within Intel to basically make Linux a viable commercial operating system. And that's not something that we hear huge amounts about.
Intel's definitely interested in making sure that Intel hardware works well with Linux. So we have a bunch of people directly working on Intel-specific hardware, making sure that it works well with Linux.
But hardware's a different
thing. For example, last year we hired Keith Packard, who is known from the X server development, and he's working on drivers for the X window system to make sure that Intel hardware works excellent with X servers. We have a number of people working on areas ranging from the kernel to audio systems.
I can understand why you would want to have guys writing, say, getting X.org working well with Intel's graphic hardware, but the desktop seems so far more abstracted from Intel hardware. It just seems interesting, you know, that you should be looking to actively make the user experience of one particular operating system, and the operating system that we're interested in, generally better, because it'll be better on AMD chips and I suppose Spark chips as well. So I'm just it just. I don't know, it just fascinates me, really.
Well, we're not that much interested in making the user experience itself better. What we are interested in is making sure that the partners that we work with, if they choose to use Linux, that the combination of Linux and Intel works well. And we can't have that if we work together with an application developer and they develop an application for one distribution, that is limited to one distribution. That doesn't scale, that doesn't work for us, because we are a global company that's active in many different markets.
Yeah.
So
right,
we would
right.
like to be able to use these kind of developments in all our markets. And Intel actually works together with companies like Red Hat to bundle their software together with our hardware and provide that to system integrators to make sure that they have an interesting set of solutions to offer to their customers.
Well.
Now, just wrapping up, just as a final question, we all know that you've been a long-standing KDE developer for a number of years and a well-respected KDE developer, and KDE4's on the cards, and you're going to be at Academy. What direction do you see KDE going in? What do you see as the future of KDE?
I don't think I'm the most qualified person to answer that. I haven't followed KDE4 too closely. I sort of follow the major directions and the things that have been changing in KDE4. I'm not driving any of that that new direction that KDE4 is taking, so I'm not sure if I can comment on that. What I think, from my perspective, what is interesting about KDE4 is the fact that Dbus has been embraced. I think that will be a great opportunity to create a platform based on services around Dbus that will be consistent regardless of whether you are using GNOME or KDE.
Cool.
And that will make it so much easier for application developers to use those services.
Well, if
you have features for application developers that are very specific to one desktop, they are very reluctant to make use of it.
So would you say that the development of Dbus and things like HAL and things like that has kind of inspired the Portland project to move forward? Because obviously Dbus is a little older now. Would you say that initial step at integrating things together inspired Portland to be formed?
I wouldn't say it inspired Portland, but it is definitely a technology that will be very interesting for Portland. And with Dbus now nearing, and I've been saying that for over a year, but with Dbus now nearing its 1.0 release, there's actually been a release candidate, I believe, this week. Dbus will become a viable candidate for this kind of interoperable use, and I'm very excited about
that.
Cool. One other quick question. The auto package people have basically built their own little set of APIs, so an auto package will install on every distribution. So they've got a little abstracted API to install an icon, a little abstracted API to put something on your desktop, and a little abstracted API to install a menu and so on. Which sounds very... It sounds like they've got their own little internal version of Portland. Have you been talking to them about bringing those two things together? Have you used any of their work, or are the two things entirely separate?
Yes, we have been talking together. We have been looking at what each other has been doing, and there has been some cross-pollination there. I think the problem with auto package is that you sort of have to buy into the whole auto package approach in order to use it. I don't think that's viable. A lot of the application developers that we talk with have their own ideas about packaging. Either they want to use RPM or they don't, or they have a very specific requirement for something.
Yep.
So I don't think that that the out-of-package solution works always. I also see a lot of pushback from the distribution with regard to out-of-package.
Yes, awful lot.
So I think, there is in a sense a lot of overlap, but Portland is a bit more limited in its scope.
Right, cool. Okay, thank you very much for talking to us.
Yeah, thanks.
Very interesting.
It's been very interesting. I think Portland's a really cool project, actually. Mm. I'd really like to see it go somewhere. So thanks very much for talking to us.
Yeah, good luck.
Cheers, Waldo.
It was a pleasure talking with you.
Brilliant.
Where are you?
Do I see you in Dublin this week?
Sadly not.
Unfortunately, no.
No, we sadly can't be there, but have a great conference.
We wish we could.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant.
Well, everyone else who will be in Dublin, I'm more than happy to talk to you about Portland if you're interested. So.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Thank you, Waldo.
Thank you very much indeed.
Cheers,
eh? Bye-bye. Cheers.
Thank you.
Bye.
One interesting thing about operating systems applications in general now is practically everything automatically updates off the internet,
right?
If you want it to. And one of the things that I've noticed, certainly with...
Well, doesn't do it automatically, does it?
Well, that's exactly the point.
Okay.
Certainly with Windows...
apply?
Big Windows deployments. Everyone's got into the habit now of download the patches and then test them and then push them out because you don't necessarily trust them to work in your environment. And if you look at... I don't want to harp on about the Ubuntu thing particularly, but when Ubuntu broke X.org, you had exactly the same thing.
Zorg.
And one of the things that I found changed for me is I used to just download and apply and not worry about it ever. And fairly recently, I've started finding myself going, I'll download this and then I'll look at what's in the list and think, what would happen if one of these things broke? If this is a kernel update, do I want to apply it now? If it's an X.org update, do I want to apply it now? And it's like, you know how there's the argument...
Well, I do exactly the same thing with Compass updates, because they quite regularly break, and it's absolutely devastating.
But they're external... just to clarify, that's an external repository, is it?
Yes.
Yeah, it's not that. Yeah. But, I mean, the thing... You know how there's the argument that someone burgles your house... And you've now been taught about the unsafety of the thing.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people use it as a justification for cracking and all that. But the argument is that the town where they used to all have their front doors open, now everyone has to have a locked door all the time. They can never go back to open doors. And I wonder whether there's a certain amount of loss of that trust now. Because now one thing's gone. Practically everybody can say, yeah, I have one update that busted my system one time. So I'll never get bitten again.
Yeah.
So now you have to check everything.
Are we all just as
a sysadmin would say, well, of course you have to check
makes
everything.
Perfect sense. Of course it does. But so are we all just a bit more mature now?
Wouldn't it be a better world if you could trust your upstream distribution?
Yeah, it'd be a better world. Yeah, but it's not going to happen, is it?
I reckon. I do trust them because I just haven't got the expertise all the time to sit and go through a load of patches and go, oh, is that going to break it? Because I don't know.
Bear with me. I'm not going through the code. Here, I'm just looking at, you know, the little Ubuntu thing lights up and I click on it and it lists the packages it's going to upgrade.
Oh.
And I think, okay, that's going to upgrade Abbey Word. If that fucks it up, I don't care that much. But I'd be a bit more leery if there was an X upgrade or a kernel upgrade.
What would you
or
do,
something
though?
I use
so
all
you'd
time,
fire
like
up your
X
virtual
term.
Machine that's an exact same spec of your desktop.
No, I mean...
Apply the patch to the VMware machine.
Would you wait for the fallout for 24 hours?
Yeah,
well, that's what I actually do.
Basically, there are two things I do. I wait a few days to see if everyone's weblog says, oh my god, X.org broke! Hmm. And... I'll make sure, if before I do the upgrade, that I close stuff that I'm working on. Just so, if it does bust my machine, at least my machine busts when I wasn't doing anything vital that I don't want to lose.
Yes. I think that's just us growing up, isn't it, really, to be honest? I mean, as you say, you know, we all used to have the door open maybe 50 years ago, but, you know, times have changed and we're not ever going to go
back to
that.
But is that not sad, though?
Well, yeah, it is,
not
but
really,
there you go.
I mean, the door thing is maybe, but, I mean, coming back to free software... sorry, I've just got myself into a bit of an awkward...
It's falling off your chair in slow motion.
You might hear the microphone go conk. Right, sorry, I just had to move myself. The door situation, obviously, it'd be nice if we could all be la-di-da. But in terms of software, I don't think it is sad
be nice if you could
or
all be
anything
la-di-da.
Like that. I think it's just wrong. We should... I mean, people like us will check the patches, perhaps, or the lists or whatever, and maybe be a bit cautious. But your dad won't. Or your sister won't, and so it's not sad. It's just got to be fixed.
I think the thing as well is that I remember when I was using Debian with Debian Unstable, I'd check before I did an upgrade every single time.
Even with
Stable,
Unstable.
Oh, with Unstable,
but,
yeah.
But that's unstable.
But hang a second. I'd check every single time because it was notorious. Well, to be honest, it was unstable. Officially, it was unstable, but it very rarely broke for me.
In practice, it was very stable. But if it broke, they go like, okay.
But I'd check it just to make sure. And the thing is with this Ubuntu thing, I mean, yeah, let's be honest, right? Something fucked up, and it's completely unacceptable.
It's happened in lots of distros,
and it shouldn't
it
have
has,
happened.
Absolutely,
but like
every distro's had their moment.
Ubuntu's grown so big that they made a fuck up, and they're going to fix it, and they are fixing it, and it's happened with other distros as well. But I think that...
But you can't ever have 100%, can you?
Exactly.
Like you can't have zero plane crashes. You're always going to have, not two.
Exactly.
Right?
It's never going to be
100%. It's still statistically brilliant, isn't it?
But there's a difference between we rolled this out and it crashed on a few people's machines. With all the technology, it crashed everyone's machine.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, most of the things that have fucked up the Ubuntu thing didn't fuck up for absolutely everybody.
Yeah.
And other things, I mean, if Suzy have had them, I imagine that's exactly the same. It screws up on an untested configuration, not absolutely frigging everybody's configuration.
But in terms of the trust thing,
I'm sure there'll be in like an inquest or whatever.
There is, right? You know, I mean, they're looking into it quite seriously.
I mean, just in general, is the lack of trust thing? I appreciate you say, yeah, you're just really naive. You don't get to trust people. You have to be really paranoid and you have to check. And you're stupid and naive if you don't do so.
But if you push that in your enterprise and all of your workforce suddenly hadn't got a fucking desktop, of course you'd have to test it.
Yeah, but people at home don't expect to even think about stuff like that. When you have a set-top box update, if you've got a television, which three out of the four of us have, and you like got Sky or something, you don't kind of run through and go, ah, well, that might
disable
Sky News.
I wonder if I should apply that patch.
News. Yeah, you
I didn't
just,
even know set-top boxes got
they
patches.
Do. They do, yeah. They it do, just yeah. happens over Jeez. The air.
Isn't that like but flashing your iPod or something?
Basically, that's exactly what it does.
That's really scary.
Well, because every now and again, they'll reach down and flash it so it forgets some of the stuff you had remembered on
fucking
PBR.
Hell, you're
stuff.
Kidding me.
But the thing is that updates for an operating system should be as, you know, you shouldn't have to think about it like that. And to be fair to the Ubuntu guys and the Fedora guys and most other distros, it is always
statistically,
works.
But, it's very rare.
Yeah, but don't think about distribution.
Think about applications as well, like Firefox, which updates itself.
But when it does fuck up, it does destroy that trust, and there's no way you're getting that back, you know. So, yeah, for a lot of people who use Ubuntu with the X...
Well, does it just open your eyes a little bit more just to stop blindly
you're
applying
saying
updates?
No way of getting the trust back, but I'm not going to change my behaviour.
No, what I'm saying is that, not necessarily for everybody, but for some people, yeah, they'll be a little bit leery the next time. I mean, to be honest, yeah, I always think twice when I accept updates.
Sure,
I always make sure nothing's open, but that's because I've used Debian before, and I was used to doing that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
But if my dad was using Ubuntu, he just wouldn't even think about it. You know. But for a business, you know, Abe mentioned the business, just the policy, you just do that.
Does your dad apply updates? Because mine doesn't even know what they are.
I think if there was a button there and it said, there are updates on your computer, he'd click OK.
There is a button. Well, there's the little icon, you've got to click it and then it brings it up.
Yeah, I mean, my dad doesn't use Ubuntu, he uses Windows, but if there's an update for his operating system, whatever it may be, he'd just, he'd basically install them blindly.
But because he's basically not competent to judge whether it might
even
break
that.
It or not.
It's a case of, you wouldn't even begin to think it would.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, he expects
anybody
it.
Without experience wouldn't think it would. But anybody with experience knows that that's a chance.
But then again, just twisting things around a little bit, I'd say that in today's kind of...
In our modern age,
with computers, I think because people are so used to viruses and spyware and all that kind of shit, there is a certain reluctance when it comes to computers. I've used my dad as an example, but there's a possibility to think, well, maybe there's going to be viruses in there. You know, he doesn't know. He can't evaluate the situation as accurately as we could. But because there's this mistrust with viruses and stuff like that, maybe people are a bit more sceptical.
Yeah, but...
And there's no way... The thing is that with most update systems, there's no way... I mean, we're technical people, we can find out if something's screwed up for other people first, but for most normal users, there's no way of checking that. Maybe that should be in update systems.
That goes back to the whole... Yeah, people will use computers as a tool and they can get a certain amount of thing out of them, but if you say to people, would you prefer a computer or a newspaper... An awful lot of people would say a newspaper. And some of that is because you can take it on the train and it doesn't run out of batteries and all that. But a lot of it is that computers are not good and they are not fun and they stop you working hard. And, you know, because sometimes when you read a newspaper on the computer crashes. And newspapers never do that. You know where you are with a newspaper. And it's really sad that that's the case because it could be so much more powerful.
Yeah, but you can pick a newspaper up and two of the pages are printed like really weirdly and you can't read a single thing
that
on it.
That never happens.
Come
that.
Off it. It on does. The free papers. Come off it.
Yeah, but does it happen on the Telegraph?
I made the Telegraph, do I?
The contemporary voice.
Little fucking Lord Fauntleroy.
I'm sorry, I don't read the Telegraph either. I read the Guardian. I just picked that paper.
But, I mean... Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Do you have
it
ironed for you, by the way?
No.
By a butler?
No.
Okay.
So what do you mean there's never mistakes in the garden? It's called the Grownie ad for a
reason.
Well,
yeah, I know. Absolutely, but people don't...
I think we're diverging.
But those things don't... make you not enjoy the paper. They don't crash the paper. They don't stop you reading it ever again.
This is page three.
They don't destroy your enjoyment of the Grawniad experience as time goes on.
The one thing when it comes to updates, the only other related thing is, your updates thing pops up, right, and it lists all of the updates for your computer, and it might be, I don't know, libxml or something update. And I don't know if I'm the only one, I just think to myself, why do I need this update?
Yeah.
You know, in what way is this relevant
to me?
Why
are you wasting my
time? I mean, I know that there's some important bug fix.
Where do you go to find out?
But that's the thing, it seems...
There should be a more button, more info.
There is, but there's no way of translating the fact that the libxml update fixes some bug fix that seg faulted if you use this particular type of XML markup.
There is a way of translating that, though. You just go, this is really important. If you do this... if not, it's not that important, but you should probably take the
But if you're basically saying to people, we're not going to tell you the reason why your system's getting updated, because you don't really need to know, why show them the updates?
Well, first of all, right, that's completely not true, because they do show you. They show you the change log. And secondly, they don't just push out stuff which is just, oh, there's a bug fix here, in the middle of, say, Dapper or Fedora Core 5 or whatever.
You get
things like security fixes.
Sure, yeah.
Which is why I trust the updates. Because I think this is a security fix or something serious. It's not just that it didn't pass some XML properly, because if it didn't do that, then unlucky, you lose.
No,
you wait for the
but
next
what
release.
I'm saying, that was a bad example. What I'm saying to you is that if something needs fixing, I shouldn't really need to know what needs fixing. I should just need to know that the fixes have been made. You know what I mean?
You just want a bloke to come around and do it for you.
That's trust again, though. You have to trust the people making the fixes to only push you fixes you actually need.
But for most of the users of Ubuntu or Fedora, and when it lists those things, they probably don't really know.
So you're saying that
are.
Just one incident of something breaking your computer has now completely destroyed all your trust?
Basically, yeah. It now means I have to check every time. It goes on the always checklist.
Did it break your computer?
It didn't break my computer.
Because you don't run proprietary drivers.
No, it didn't break my computer because I didn't upgrade. I happened to be away from my computer for a day, and when I came back, everyone's weblog said, oh my God, it's broken
X. You don't run proprietary drivers.
And I don't run proprietary. I don't even know whether it would have broken my computer.
No, because you don't run proprietary drivers.
Right, okay, well, fair play. So I would have been okay then. But I didn't want to know that. I just thought, right, okay, there's a problem there. But now, I have to wait 2 days before I apply an update, every time, in case that happens again. You only get to fuck up once.
Well, that, yeah.
Okay, we're talking to John Cherry, who's keynoting at Academy next week.
Hello, John.
What's up? Hello, John.
Good afternoon. Good to talk to you.
Good evening. I think you're fine.
Exactly right.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're going to be doing at Academy?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm the initiative manager for the Desktop Linux Initiative at OSDL.
Sorry?
I'm initiative manager. Initiative manager.
What's an initiative manager?
Well, OSDL is a conglomeration of companies that really want to accelerate the use of Linux, and I manage this conglomeration of companies as we look at desktop markets.
Okay.
So that's what I do.
Okay, cool.
And what we're going to do at Academy is we're going to look at the state of the Linux desktop from an OSDL perspective, so from the perspective of our member companies and what they would like to see in the desktop, what markets they're going to be focusing on, that kind of thing.
Cool. Okay. So, I want to talk a bit about Academy itself. I mean, why do you think it's important to go and talk at Academy rather than, we were at Guadec and I didn't see you there. I just didn't meet you.
First of all, I should have been there.
All right, yes, you should have done, actually.
Next year I'll be there. Hey. The main reason we're looking at Academy is when you look at inhibitors and what we really want to do to enable applications on the desktop, it comes down to, what can we do for cross-distro compatibility and what can we do for cross-desktop compatibility. And by cross-desktop, I mean desktop environments like KDE, GNOME, and the others.
Right, yeah.
Right.
So we're going to be addressing those issues and talking about those and talking about things like, runtime integration, things like the Portland Project, common package formats, all those kinds of things that for an application make Linux look like Linux, not like a distro with a particular desktop environment running on it.
Oh, okay.
There's been a lot of discussion in the past about ways in which the distros can work together. Do you believe any of this kind of stuff is actually going to happen? Because obviously, it basically boils down to community and whether the different communities want to work together. So, do you believe it's these kind of grand plans that have been discussed with things like Portland? Are they actually going to catch on and be implemented in distros?
Well, actually, we have assurances that the tools involved in the Portland project will be picked up by the major distros fairly quickly.
Okay.
The distros in general are picking up the fact that, you know, we can't segment the Linux market. We have to grow the Linux market. And, you know, adopting things like the Portland Project interfaces are going to go a long way in making applications cross-distro, cross-desktop, and hence improve the market.
How easy is it to realize synergies between the desktops? I mean, how can we find ways of work, getting GNOME and KDE to work together without compromising what they do?
Actually, you know, we want to encourage innovation in areas where there's, you know, distinction and where there is innovation still going on. So in that respect, competition is good. It spurs innovation. It's just good for the open source communities in the market. Where we really want to look for cooperation is especially in the areas of application availability.
Yeah.
How do we get applications to just run on any desktop?
Just work.
Yeah, that's ideal.
So there are certain areas where cooperation is good, certain areas where still competition is the thing that spurs innovation and fun.
Just moving on to... Oh, sorry, I forgot what it's called. Moving on to Academy itself.
Yeah.
What is the... Obviously, that's the key focus of the year for the KDE community. And although there are people such as yourself and people from Intel and that going to Academy, what sort of benefit can commercial companies and organizations gain from attending community? Sorry, it's been a long dirt work. Right, I will start that again. Hopefully I'll be edited out.
Right.
Sorry. What benefit can OSDL, Intel, and other corporations and commercial entities gain from attending community events like Academy?
Well, in the open source market, I mean, it's obvious that there is kind of a codependence now between corporations and developers in the community.
Of course, yeah.
Corporations always have the option to take open source and do with it what they want to, but all the synergies and benefits that are gained through the open source movement are gained by working together with the community. So equipment vendors, you know, like the ones you mentioned, definitely have an interest in working with the community in developing platforms. Uh-huh. Linux distributions have the same motivating factors to go to a conference like this. Certainly, application vendors, when they look at porting new applications to Linux environments, have a desire to work with the desktop community. So that's really where the synergies come.
I mean, obviously, Academy is obviously very focused on KDE. That's why people are there.
Absolutely.
And there's been a lot of discussion in recent months about KDE 4 and things like Plasma and the future direction of KDE. Where do you believe that the KDE project should be going? What's your if you could build the Cherry desktop environment, what would you want to see?
Well, you know, when people incorporate a desktop environment, or I should say, have a run whatever they do on their Linux desktop, they could really care less what operating system they're running on. And for the most part, you know, I hate to say it, they could care less what desktop environment they're running on.
Yeah, yeah.
What matters is the application that I'm used to, that I got used to in other environments, going to be available for me in a Linux environment. And so the ideal direction for desktops to take for the markets that we're involved in is how can we better support moving new applications to Linux?
Right,
how can we better support moving the applications that people like and are used to to Linux. So that's the direction, you know, that I would like to see the desktops take. There's all sorts of WYSIs and gizmos flashy stuff that can be added to the desktop. And, you know, 3D, desktop acceleration, all this kind of stuff. All that stuff is good, but it's Flash.
But
what will really expand the markets are, you know, applications.
One thing that we've spoken about before on this show and that I've thought about personally is the idea that we've got increasing commercial interest in the free software open source world now. How can we as a community, on the community side, leverage that so that we can help see what we believe to be the right way of developing software, the open source way, become more mainstream?
Leverage.
I do believe that we are seeing a shift in even who make up the open source community these days. It used to be a lot of hobbyist things, you know, people that were working on it for their, you know, their own interests, their own desires. And you take a poll of those that are working in these .orgs now, and most of them are employed in some way, directly or indirectly, by corporate entities that are delivering products based on Linux or desktop environments like this. So I think naturally those things are going to happen just by who's making up these .orgs now.
Hmm. Cool. Well, John, it's been...
Fantastic.
It's been enlightening talking to you because the OSDL is an organization that we, you know, often read about, and obviously you guys pay for Linus Torvalds' Cocoa Pops and everything.
We do.
So it would, you know, it's really good to actually hear from you. Thanks very much for your insight on the desktop, and perhaps we could catch up with you another time in a few months, perhaps.
Very welcome. I hope to see you soon.
Fantastic.
Great. Thanks,
John.
Cheers. Bye.
Bye.
We've been talking to a few people in this episode about Academy, big KDE conference, and those of you who were listening to the show last series will know that three of us, not Matt, unfortunately, went to GuadEC, the equivalent GNOME conference.
It's going to next year's.
No excuse for any of us to not turn up to next year.
It's about 500 yards down the road. And it got me thinking about kind of conferences in general. I mean, you've got two different sorts. You've got real kind of community, grassroots, everyone gets together and writes code the whole time.
Yep.
Conferences like GuadEC and Academy, and then you've got things like Linux World and so on.
Yes.
I mean, in Australia, you've got the huge linux.conf.au thing, which is absolutely massive, and everyone in Australia seems to go to it.
I mean, is that a combination of the two?
I don't know very much about it. But it got me thinking about, do you think conferences in general are a good idea? What do you think makes a good conference? What do you think makes a bad one? Why would you go to one and not to another?
Yeah, it's pretty binary. Some conferences rock, and some just really badly suck. So
yeah, I think it depends what you want to get out of it. Because like Aid said earlier on when we weren't recording, you know, if you're a community person, then you're probably going to enjoy something like GuadEC. But if you're a community person, you're probably not going to enjoy something maybe like Linux World, because it's a different
type
of thing.
On the other hand, if you're an enterprise person,
you're going to love it, Linux World.
But do you though? I mean,
you're not just going to go along and go, "Oh, I ticked a couple of boxes there."
I don't know. I'd say for enterprise people, I think it's a nice day out for them. It's a day out of the office for a lot of people, isn't it? You know, they can kind of go out somewhere, they can talk to some people, and they might not make any business.
And the stuff there is aimed at them, to be fair. It's not aimed at us.
It's not very often you can get all of those people in the same
room.
I don't
care about Veritas backup for Linux.
No, but presumably there are lots of people who do. Ooh, are there, and they all go to Linux World.
No, but it's good
and,
to be
and
aware.
They don't go to Lug Radio Live, for example.
Of course
they
don't.
No, I mean, it's interesting, because there is this really, to my mind at least, there's this really big split in between corporate sort of conferences and community sort of conferences. And award ceremonies are very similar.
So you're saying what you'd like to say, you'd like to see both in the same
I don't know what I mean, the .org village really doesn't seem like a good compromise.
No, it isn't
the
hat, is it?
In the same way that, I mean, imagine Lug Radio Live. Which
it's better than nothing.
I would consider the Lug Radio Live to be a community conference. But imagine if we had the Soup Village. The exhibition area completely was not the Soup Village. No, it was the .org village. But imagine you had the Veritas backup people. Every time someone walked past, they went, "Here's a leaflet. Please think about buying BitRock Defender for Linux or whatever." But it totally wouldn't fit in. And the .org village, to me, seems exactly the same way.
That's why you have different conferences, isn't it?
We have discussed conferences in the past quite a bit, which is why we ended up with Lug Radio Live, I think.
Yeah.
But you mentioned something there which rises out of a conversation we were having earlier, which is the award ceremonies.
Yeah.
And that is something that kind of gets my goat a little bit.
What's your goat's name?
Well, Bessie. Linux User Award Ceremony.
Because very unusual name for a goat.
It is.
Pedigree name, I take
it. What do you know about names for goats?
I got some unsolicited commercial
John
email.
John is very close to goats.
Read it on the internet.
Yeah. Sorry, Matthew, carry on.
I got some email the other day. And
did you get an internet?
I did, yeah.
Did it come over the tubes?
Yep, that's right. It gave me this offer that quite astounded me, knocked me back. It said,
was it to make your cock
had
hard?
Had you well, won the lottery?
Was it getting some lucky the lottery one I could get in all the time? Was it about teens?
No MILFs. Anyway, I was sitting there rocking in my chair.
Bet you were.
With your Viagra and teens email.
It was about goats, wasn't it?
Yeah. And various other things.
Oh, ghost. I thought you said goat.
Anyway, after that particular one, I got, "Dear Mr. Ravel, here's a very special offer. If you order before this certain date, you can get you and 9 friends or whatever can get a table for 10 at the Linux User Awards for 1,200 or something stupid
what?
Pounds
like 1,200
that.
Quid?
Yeah. So
no, that's a bargain.
I get to go along and see
it's not a bargain,
Jono
that's an
in
outrageous
a
amount of money.
I get to
it?
Go along and see Jono in a tux for 120 quid.
It's worth the money, isn't it?
Plus however much else to
bacon,
take my mates.
This is the one you're judging, is it?
Was that the prime table or something?
No, that's just a normal table.
Oh, right.
Now, I'm not bothered about the charge or whatever so much. I mean, that was kind of astonishing. But I thought, I'm going to blog about this, I thought I'll have a look into it a bit more so I can give them an educated chewing. And
that's the first time for everything on Look Radio.
If you're going to shoe someone, it wouldn't hurt to do some background research.
So I started looking.
Matt, you're fired.
And I looked at the people who were up for awards, and I thought about the people who'd won last year, and I looked at the judging panel, and I thought to myself, well, 3 of the people I know personally, so I don't really want to give them too much of a shoe-in. But now that we've begun talking about it tonight, I thought, you know, it's worth mentioning. And things like the Linux User Awards, where they are basically just, let's face it, an income stream for Linux User, leave me feeling hollow.
Controversial.
No, it is. I mean, it just plainly is.
Well, yeah. You know, it completely is. All these big venues and stuff. I mean, do they make a lot of money? I don't know whether
they will make.
They're charging £1,200 a table.
They must make a lot of money.
Come
if they charge £1,200 a table.
And that's a special offer, isn't it?
Money.
It's something like £1,500 if you don't do it by the end of next.
I mean, how many people on the table? Are they £1,500? £1,500 people.
Can I just very quickly finish what I was going to say? Right. It leaves me feeling hollow because it has nothing to do with our community. And I know that you were saying that there's kind of a corporate, you know, community split. And fair enough. Okay, good on them. If corporate people want to go and spend £1,200 on a few crudités and a bit of champagne, then good on them. But we, you know, it kind of, I don't know, it's just got nothing to do with our experience of Linux
but
and free
it's
software.
It's not community awards, is it?
It's not purported to be that, to be fair.
No, I'm not saying it is. What I'm saying is, there is a gap.
Do you think that it's reasonable? I mean, yeah, it's not purported to be that. But that means that there are basically two completely separate worlds. You've got a corporate world where people wear suits and buy things one, and they give one another awards. Okay. And then you've got the community where the community give one another awards. And there's no commonality between the two at all. I mean, is that a reasonable way
to
be?
It feels that way, to be honest.
I feel like I should put my position forward of being one of the judges on the Linux User Awards. I mean, let's be honest. Award ceremonies are there to bring in money from the people who buy the tables. That's what they're there for. Yeah, I don't believe that the people. I might be stepping out of line here, but I don't believe that the people who run award ceremonies necessarily want to identify the contributions in the IT community.
Well, that's really sad.
They want to make they want to make a load of money from people like Sun.
So it's not about rewarding vendors who've done the best job.
I don't believe the people who set up award ceremonies.
That might be wrong.
Might
be a happy coincidence,
but I think
it's not the primary aim.
But I think the primary aim is to make money. They're a money making scheme.
Yeah, like most things in the world.
I feel like someone's just told me Santa doesn't exist.
Now, my personal interest in being part of the Linux User Awards or any awards,
you get a big bag
panel.
Of money.
No, you get a great big bag of money.
No, I'm not getting paid for it. No, my personal interest is that although
you're paid for all the dinner, are you?
No, I'm getting paid to go to the. I'm not getting paid to go to it, but I'm going to be at the.
You're
going to
eat £2,000 worth of sausage rolls.
And I'm not going to deny the fact I love going to awards ceremonies. I just think they're fucking great. I get loads of free booze.
You get to wear a tux.
Get to wear my tux, which I love wearing my tux, and it's great.
Caviar and champagne.
But the thing is that if I'm going to be part of a judging team, I want to make sure that it's fair, and I want to make sure that my opinions are fair on it. And that's the reason why I take part in it. I mean, yeah, there's the perk of being at the awards thing, but part of the reason why I wanted to do it is because if I'm part of it, I know that I am going to be straight. I can't speak for the other judges. From looking at the judging panel, they all seem like really sound people who are going to provide a fair opinion of things.
Sure.
Right? Yep. And I know I'm going to provide a fair opinion of things. I can't speak for other people, but... You know, so that's the reason why I'm involved with it.
Yeah, but then you look at the award ceremonies and who's nominated, and it's like, oh, okay.
But the thing is as well is that you got to look. One thing you got to look at with award ceremonies is
Ersie nominated. Sorry.
The thing with award ceremonies is that sometimes I'm not speaking for any particular award ceremonies, but with other award ceremonies, vendors don't put in submissions. You know, so they if the vendors don't put in the proposals to be nominated,
you keep saying that word vendors,
eh?
I mean, that's the crux of it, though, isn't it? It's vendor.
Oh, yeah, of course, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
But if the vendors don't put in the submissions, and the vendors don't win awards, the vendors don't buy tables, the awards generally don't tend to happen. Right? Yeah. So, there's a certain amount of... It's very corporate, because at the end of the day, awards wouldn't happen if Jacosha won an award, and if Gnome won an award. And yet, the Gnome Foundation might be able to buy a table, and Ack and I might be able to throw 25 quid in a pot and... by one chair leg of a table. But, of course, it's perfectly normal for Sun and IBM to buy big tables because it's not only about winning awards, which is kudos for them, but it's also about networking with their peers.
Circle jerk, did you say?
Yeah. I don't think anybody should...
No, there's anything wrong with networking or anything
with
like
jerking.
That. I just... it just, like I say, it just leaves me a bit hollow thinking... It's not really what it's not really what we do all this for. And okay, if they want to do that, that's fine.
The thing is,
it's done in the name of Linux, and there's more Linux than that. There's us as well.
The thing is, as well, the other thing I was going to say is part of the reason why I want to take part in the awards. Well, the major reason is so I can at least vote for the free software projects.
Yeah.
Because in awards judging that I've been in before, typically it's very corporate faced because people put their submissions in and they're buying the tables and the rest of it.
Mm.
And I want to make sure that people like Spread Firefox. Mm. Are recognised.
People
like, you know, Debian are recognised.
Yeah.
You know.
I must confess, I mean, I'll be diverging things a little bit here, but those of you who listened to the show for a while will know I work for a law firm, and there are legal IT awards, the whole legal IT community, and the award ceremonies, there are three or four different ones throughout the year. I find myself being very frustrated with them because it doesn't half feel like a little backslapping session between the whole same batch of people.
Well, it's the same with
people.
Movie, fucking...
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the movie thing, the Oscars are exactly the same. And
there must be another way.
It does seem a bit, you know, you think, well, the whole thing just kind of feeds on itself and it perpetuates itself, but why? I mean, if it went away, the whole thing went away, the whole corporate awards concept went away, would the world be any worse off? And the answer is no.
It's not just awards, though, is it? I mean, it's like... You know, it's certain conferences. I'm not going to say any names, but certain conferences are renowned for being the land of the backslapper.
Mm.
You know, they're places where the same people show up every year and basically massage each other's egos.
Mm.
And those places, I'd suspect for a lot of people, aren't interesting to visit.
Mm.
I think a lot of people are interested in going to Academy, interested in going to Guardic, interested in going to Look Radio Live, because they don't get any of that.
Yeah, I mean,
and awards ceremonies. In general, there are exceptions, of course, and certain conferences are just that whole kind of, like, cliquey kind of...
Yeah, I mean, it just seems to be occasionally like a bit of a con, because ordinary people who don't really know whether this is a good award or that bad award, see, you won this 2005 award. You think, well, that must make you good. You think, but, you know, this whoever that particular vendor is, they always win one award at that ceremony.
It's
the same bunch of eight vendors.
No, hang on a second. Now, I don't think that's fair, because I think... Certainly with the Linux User Awards, the one thing I know about them is that they are fairly judged. I don't believe there's any, this vendor is going to have special treatment. I think they are fairly judged.
It's not always, I mean, I'm not particularly talking about the Linux User Awards here, just sort of corporate awards in general. I mean, yeah, you say, well, fairly judged, but it's always the same eight companies who get nominated.
But invariably, yeah.
So basically everyone gets their turn over an 8-year period, is the way it seems to work out in the legal industry, at least. That's the way it feels to me.
And that's why I think it's particularly important to have people who are there to recognise the...
Hence your participation.
You know, which I'm hoping is going to be the case at Linux... User and Developer Awards as well, so.
Right, it's the end of the show. Hey. We haven't got any emails, no. So we thought it's long overdue that we do some thanking.
Yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
Yeah, and survey forms.
We thought we'd all have a thank.
Right, who's lucky, Pierre? Oh, it's me.
No, eyes aren't looking at me.
Okay.
Who are we going to thank first? Maybe the ninjas.
I
think the Lug Radio Ninjas, actually.
Shazaliel and Nuro, and is there anyone else?
There are a few other people who hang about in the Lug Radio Ninjas channel.
Yeah.
Mr. Ben, Dot Waffle, yeah. Leo. And they've been very helpful. As some of you may have noticed, we've had a couple of problems with lugradio.org over the years. And that's mainly because neither Jono nor I have a fucking clue about being a sysadmin.
But insist on having your own server.
Well, yeah.
Eventually,
they took pity on us and said, can we help? And we said, yeah, hell yes, you can help. Have a load of stuff to host and tell us how to fix Angel. And we've been working through it. I've been working through it with them.
Chris Proctor gave me a book.
It helped a great deal.
Chris Proctor gave me a book about how to do the LPI exam. And he said, this will help you with that with Angel. And I actually put it on my monitor, and nothing fucking happened. Bastard. I might have to actually read something in the book.
Totally,
we are useless.
But yes, we are useless. The
Hang on, you've just
useless,
written a book about Ubuntu.
Yes.
Yeah, but not about administering it. It's all
yes,
about...
Yes, but you have written a book about
administering. Yes, I have.
This is the scam of corporate... life in, yes. in blah blah blah.
It
anyway,
is,
yeah. It's great to see the anger coming back from Matt, don't you think?
Yes, yeah, the anger returns.
Excellent. Anyway, thanking who next?
To do corporate shilling and
Bite Mark
the
for their very reliable machines.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Bite Mark. Thank you for.
That's my chin expanding.
thank you very much, Bite Mark. Have you ever seen audio.logradio.org go down? No, never. That was donated by them. It's been nothing but perfect. The reason Angel goes down is because we do too much on it.
Yeah, right.
Basically, audio just serves the audio files and
Slayer.
It's rock solid.
Slayer's been rock solid.
It's a hell of a lot of bandwidth.
Mm.
Yes, it does. It's a hell of a lot of bandwidth, and that was a pure donation from them.
So, joking aside, thanks to Bite Mark.
Thank you very much, Matt Block and Patrick at Bite Mark.
And all the other guys.
And all the other guys at Bite Mark.
Thanks also to Level 3 and Carl Frost, otherwise known as Trig. For hosting the forums.
Yeah, because they
generate... And keeping them up to date.
They generate a fair amount of bandwidth as well.
Yeah, and they're always rock solid as well. Have you ever seen the forums go down?
Once or twice.
No.
Bad. No, they have been pretty solid, and we are very appreciative. Thank you very much indeed.
It's not very often you see forum sites actually flourish. A lot of people set up sites and then nothing happens.
Yeah.
Well, ours have just remained consistent.
Yeah.
Yep. It's because we are
excellent since the beginning. They are a really valuable part of the community, and Trig makes that happen. Thank you, Trig. I don't know whether his employers know that he makes it happen.
Yeah, I think he does.
Thanks to all the people who take time to let us interview them as well.
Yeah.
You know, they do it for nothing.
It's nice for people to come on the show because,
they get to talk to people.
Sometimes... people get a bit of a beating on Lug Radio. And it's quite nice that they still come on.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, one of the things we wanted to say to you, our community, is that, you know, we do...
We're having a touchy-feely moment.
We do interviews because people like to hear what's going on around different projects and so on. But we'd be interested in what else you'd like to see in Lug Radio.
Got a whole season in front of us.
We have, absolutely. We're very near the beginning of a season here, only three shows in. So tell us what you'd like to see.
Yeah.
So there's an ideas for the show forum on the forums at forums.lugradio.org.
And an interesting thing as well is that we've been discussing recently, and some people have asked us to do, and we thought, yeah, not a bad idea, is, you know, you don't have to be kind of someone who's well-known and written about on Slashdot to get on the show. If you are doing something interesting, whether it's in your local lug or you've just created a 3D scanner or something like that, then give us a bell or preferably drop us an email to show
at... Because the phone line doesn't work.
Yeah, to show at lugradio.org. And, you know, we'll...
Is that running on Angel as well?
We'd be interested to talk to you.
No.
Oh, right.
No, I mean, keep your suggestions for Lug Radio Live USA coming in if you're...
Yes.
Yeah. Let's have some proposals.
If you're putting together those proposals, we'd love to hear those as well.
The thing that we've always said is we always want to be a show for the people. That's what we're here for.
By the people, for the people.
We are a community show, and we never, ever want that to stop. No matter how popular Lug Radio gets or how many people come to Lug Radio Live, we want to always be community-focused. But
how many Ferraris you see us driving
exactly, you know? I mean, another Ferrari?
What was it you're just about to purchase there?
What are you about to purchase?
A brand spanking new Audi A6.
Admittedly, that's not with
that's
Lug
not
Radio
from
money.
Donations from the show,
the
though.
The V6 engine one as well, just to point out. Well,
it's from all of your donations, AIDS driving around in Audi A6.
The tip jar, we've got... Fuck all, AIDS got an A6.
Amnesty International.
Whatever. Whatever.
But yeah, it, you know, But for us to keep the show community focused, we need to hear what you want, and we need people who are doing cool stuff to get in touch with us. So do that, because as much as we spent a lot of season 3 talking to famous people, we never want to stop speaking to less famous people who are doing this equally cool stuff.
So, yeah. Is there anyone else we've forgotten to thank?
There's bound to be. There's bound to be.
There are loads of things that go on to make Lug Radio Live happen. I mean, the bit we do here in Jono's pit
bit.
Of shite, we have to sit in here every 2 weeks. Look at it, for God's sake. It's appalling.
They can't look at it.
But
they're listeners.
We should take some pictures.
We should take photos.
But, I mean, the bit we
what
do
shame
is...
shame we're interested in it.
Is only part of what makes Lug Radio what it is.
Yes.
it is a thing. Sorry.
Yeah, no, go.
I was going to say, I quite enjoyed having the old Scott James Remnant in the studio last week.
It's always good. It's good when we had Ted in as well.
Yeah,
yes. And
it's great having guests in.
You know, so if you've got any suggestions for people who you reckon we should have in the studio, bearing in mind they've got to be fairly local or prepared to travel at their own expense.
And not nutters as well.
And they must run Gnome.
Not annoying people, please.
It's in my house, so if... If someone wants to be on the show, then I've got to vet them that they're not some kind of nutter. And importantly, if they can't get the train back, they're going to be sleeping in my spare room. So if Captain Weird decides to come on the show for an interview...
Newfle, I can't understand he usually looks Jeffrey Dahmer.
So, thank you very much, everyone, for listening.
Yes.
Thank you, guys, for sitting here each fortnight. Mm. You know,
thank ourselves. That's my back slappy on.
Yeah.
I love you guys.
Let's give ourselves a corporate award. Right.
Fantastic. Right, we'll catch you in 2 weeks, guys.
Yep, it's been great. See you in 2 weeks.
Bye. Goodbye.
Bye.